Testing. All right. All right. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Perfect. Let me just finish up the emails in the middle of real quick.
Yep, sure.
A couple quick questions before we get started. Do you prefer Chris or Christopher?
Chris is fine.
Okay. And how exactly do you want me to introduce you? Do you want me to introduce you as the founder and CEO of Think Penguin or something else?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Okay, so I'm going to kick off the recording on my side.
All right. I started the recording on my side already, so.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
What I will do is we will do a countdown. I'll do a countdown from five. And then when you think I'm about to say two and one, you say that as well. That'll give me a spot to be able to sync the audio and also give me an idea to know about what kind of delay we have.
Okay.
Five, four, three,
two, one.
Okay, good. All righty. And as I said before, if for some reason I ask a question you don't want to answer, that's fine. You can just tell me you don't want to answer and I can cut that out.
Okay.
If you're giving an answer and you decide, actually, hold on, there's a better way for me to phrase that, you can just stop, start your sentence over again, and I can clip out the spot before.
Sure.
The benefit of, you know, doing all the editing and releasing in post is I can do that stuff if I need to.
Okay.
I'm sure you've done similar things on stuff that you've been a part of in the past. So
I honestly hate editing and will avoid okay. it at all costs. And most of the stuff that I do, it goes out live anyway over like radio. So there ain't no opportunity to edit anything.
Yeah.
There's a dump well, I guess button. If
it's, yeah, I was going to say, if it's radio, there's like that 30-second or whatever yeah, delay. Yeah. Oh, well, nope, that can't go out. But
yep.
Okay. So I'm ready to go if you are.
Sure. Let's start.
Okay. With me on the show today is Chris Wade. Chris is the founder and CEO of Think Penguin. Chris, thanks for setting aside some time to speak with me today.
It's wonderful to be here.
So I can't remember exactly when the first time I met you was. It would have definitely been at some open source conference somewhere where you were at the Think Penguin booth. But I do remember the thing that stood out to me the most is that it was apparent immediately that you have a passion for free and open source software. But before we get into that, I figured let's roll the clock back. I want to get a little bit of backstory. Do you remember when you were younger, was like there a point where you were like, hey, this technology thing is really interesting. I want to do that.
Yes. I mean, yeah, I was probably like 10 or 11 maybe ish. Yeah.
Okay. Do you happen to remember, cause people always are interested in finding out people that have been around what they started out on. Do you remember the first computer that you used?
Yeah,
what it was.
Yeah, it was an Apple IIe. I was 4 years old.
Okay.
1988.
So at what point did you first become aware of open source software?
Probably like 94-ish, probably about 1994.
Okay. Do you remember what the situation was or what you noticed that got you that you saw?
Oh wow. Going back to those days, it was probably like it was Red Hat. I know it was Red Hat. I don't think I know it was Red Hat. It was like I don't remember what version specifically, but it was some Red Hat release before it was Red Hat Enterprise Linux or Fedora or what they've changed the names a few times over the years, but yeah, it was just Red Hat. And that's what I remember mostly. And the dial-up. I remember trying to get dial-up working and trying to get it to installed and booting and working. And back in those days, it was a lot more effort to do pretty much anything with your computer. You had DIP switches and all sorts of different things to finagle in order to get the computer to pretty much do anything. So yeah, I think it was a 50 megahertz like IBM PS2, I believe. I think it had like 50, well, it was 50 megahertz. I believe it was 50 megahertz. Yeah, it's definitely 50 megahertz. And I don't know if it had four, probably had more than 4 megabytes of RAM at that point. But by that time, I actually, installed Red Hat for the first time. But it was definitely an interesting experience, especially trying to get. And it's interesting. It was interesting because there wasn't. It wasn't like a. Today, it's really pretty easy to install any kind of GNU Linux distribution. But back in those days, they didn't. When you had a second hard drive, so the first hard drive was a 244 megabyte hard drive, and the second one was like a 2.7 gigabyte hard drive, I believe. Oh wait a minute, that maybe that came later. That might have actually come later. But anyway, it still was in the early days, and at that time, the second hard drive it didn't there it the BIOS doesn't detect it. There was something called an over. I think it was overlay. Basically, it's installed. You had to install it to like the bootloader. And it caused all sorts of problems. So, but I think one of the tricks, if I recall correctly at the time, was you could do it to like a floppy disk, and so you could stick the floppy disk in order to boot it up or whatever. And the problem with installing Linux, I think, was that I couldn't install to the bootloader because the overlay program basically was there. So if you tried to install the bootloader, it wouldn't work. And so the whole thing would just, fail on you. So I think I had to, there was a little hack I had to do to get it working. But that's kind of cool.
So you started with Red Hat. What was your distro journey like? Because I know a lot of GNU Linux and open source people, they started with one, but over the years they kind of migrate and try a whole bunch of them and settle on some for a while and then move on to others. So I'm just kind of curious what yours was.
I've never been a distro hopper, but I have used every distribution under the sun. I tend to like to stick to a distribution for long lengths of time, just because I mean I'm just not I'm I actually trying to do like productive stuff on my computer. And so if you're constantly installing and reinstalling and installing something else, you don't get much done. So when I install a distribution, it usually is on a fresh, clean machine, and it's not my like main machine or my work machine or whatever. If I'm trying something else new out or whatever, and I will switch distributions, but most of the time when I've been switching distributions over the years, it was to see the differences between distributions. But especially now when I switch distributions, it is because I'm trying to be a distro hopper, because I need to know the different user interfaces, different desktop environments, how Arch works relative to Fedora or Debian or whatever. And certain distributions, they haven't ch I mean there's been a lot of changes too, like over the years. Like I guess it hasn't really been that many changes, but there's been some changes, like obviously systemd. And there's been with Fedora, you basically went from was it d dn I want to say d dnr for do not resuscitate, but it's dnf. So it went from yum to dnf. And so like there's these little changes that have occurred like over the years. And if you don't distro hop to some degree, and that's kind of what you do for to support, your skills will end up getting rusty. So I like to hop around to some degree, but like if you actually start looking at like what is my main system that I'm using at any given time, it's like, oh, there's a new release out. The old release isn't discontinued yet, and I'm still on that for like way, way longer than I probably should be. And I don't mean like from a security perspective, it's fine because there's still security updates for it, but for somebody you would think is in the business, you think they're going to be doing, I think, more, you know, up constantly upgrading and, you know, constantly being on top of things. And I am from a security perspective, but I'm not from a, you know, from like just getting, you know, because I need to have that, you know, I need my main desktop at least to be, or laptop, to be productive. And so I don't like to break things. I don't like to install random software. And that's also good from a security perspective. I actually do the same thing with like my phones. You know, I will upgrade, you know, for security, but I won't install random software that I don't trust, you know, that there's not source code for, a full set of source code for, you know, et cetera. But the phones are complicated because phones are kind of a nightmare just all over. You know, you can't, I mean, there's Replicant, but even with Replicant, you still have proprietary firmwares, you know, for the modem, basically, you know, the modem portion of the device. So even if you know, your Wi-Fi might not, your well, I can tell you, your Wi-Fi won't work if you're using Replicant. And your Bluetooth, I don't know, Bluetooth might work. I think the
Yeah, I don't know.
GPS won't work, but yeah, there's all these pieces that won't work. And this is the thing that I have a really hard time doing is I want to use Replicant. I want to use, you know, some of the freer options, but it's really it's still a bit of a challenge in some instances. But there is but what I have a really hard time doing is like telling and helping people with distributions that I would rather not be helping with, because I don't like people, you know, getting dependent on proprietary, you know, bits of software. And but at the same time, it's like I know that if I were to tell them, oh, go use X, Y, and Z, they're going to fail, and then they're going to go back to Windows or Mac or something else. And so I know I need to give them something. I want to give them, I'm going to give them something that's as free as possible as far as the hardware is concerned, but then the distribution that they're using ends up not being free. And it's usually because, you know, it comes down to one, they're buying new hardware. And so something like Triskel 9, for example, which is based off Ubuntu 18.04, that's not going to work. And I can't give them something like Parabola because Parabola is a rolling distribution, and rolling distributions break. And don't even get me
Right.
started at what a nightmare it is to install Parabola, or even Arch is a little bit better, but Parabola is there's bugs that are not documented. So even if you follow the directions perfectly, unless you go and you talk to other people who are using Parabola, you might not know, you know, why it's failing, and you might not be able to figure it out. And then, you know, somebody, if you, but if you talk to other people, then you'll find out. And it's kind of a sore point, I think, with something like Parabola, unfortunately. But you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, I've always kind of taken the tack of if I want to get someone off, say, Windows or Mac, I will first try to get them in onto using GNU Linux. And then later I'll try to take the next step and get, okay, well, let's go a little bit further to take it in baby steps. Because yeah, if you just dump someone onto it, you know, a GNU Linux installation that has some rough edges that they're not really comfortable with, they're gonna bail. And I think it's more important to get them started down the right path. Like, let's get them in the point in the right direction so that we can then get them to the ultimate goal of using just free and open source software. And another thing is I've always found it interesting the dichotomy between the people that use stable versus the people that use bleeding edge. Because it's an interesting kind of split between general community. Now, obviously, there's a lot of overlap. I use both, but for my day to day, I prefer a much more stable OS, which I use Slackware. But I still update the packages as much as possible within that window. Certain things that I have to go with, like the latest source, I can build myself. But I have plenty of friends that are just like bleeding edge of the rolling distribution. That's where they want to be.
Yeah,
It's always something that I found interesting.
I can't handle that. You know, when I'm working, I can't have my printer, you know, my printers break because the cups gets updated, and of course the new configure you need a new configuration file, or you need to modify the configuration file or whatever, and you don't even know why it's not printing, and you don't have the 15 minutes that it's going to take to research it and fix it. And that's an example. I was running. Trying to think what I was running. I was running one of the ro I was running a rolling release distribution. Oh, I think it was Mendri no, not Mendrivia. That's not rolling. Mid no, not Pangea. Oh, Mendrivia doesn't even exist. it was I'm thinking Pangea, but I'm trying to think what the pop. What's one of those popular distributions right now? It's like at the top of the list.
I know Manjaro has been getting popular. That's based on Arch.
Manjaro.
Okay.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, Manjaro. That's what I was using. And that was actually, that example I was given was exactly what I was using at the time. And my printer system broke. And it's crazy because it was actually easy to use. It was easy, or let me rephrase, it was easy to set up and install and use for the most part. And it was pretty stable. And then it wasn't. It took 3 months, but it broke, you know. And that's why I tend to prefer, you know, and most users wouldn't be able to fix that type of problem. So it's definitely you know, and there's been some pretty crazy distributions that I've used too, actually. Here I'm trying. Slint, I think, was one. Have you ever heard of Slint? I think it was
Slint. I have heard people like mention the name, but that's all I've ever heard. I've never gotten any more information about it.
So if I'm not mistaken about the name, Slint is a distribution. Is it based on Slackware? It might be based on Slackware. And it basically is designed for people who are visually impaired or blind. And it's got some really neat features in it, but like there's some really oddball distributions that I've touched over the years, and it's in recent years, because we have a small percentage of our customer base is blind, so I'm constantly getting asked questions and researching questions, and so one of the ones I spent some time on in the past couple of years was that. So it's like, yeah, and there's some of the older distributions. We actually funded a distribution way back when, 5, 6, 7 years ago, to try and solve some of those problems for blind users, and unfortunately that distribution went under, but there is a distribution currently out there for blind users. It's just really hard to find out about it, because it's not, there's all this information about like older distributions that were targeting, you know, that world, but there's no, it's all the stuff that comes up in a search is out of date. So it was really hard to locate the distribution, but we located it, figured it out, found out, oh yes, this is good. This is well maintained and everything else. There are other people, you know, using it and everything else. And it actually works really well, but I think it was because of Slint actually that got me to touch Slackware. Because that's actually one of the few distributions that I haven't touched very much, just because it's not a very commonly requested distribution. I think the last time like I really had somebody I was really talking about, like, I know there's some people that I interact with every once in a while that are diehard Slackware users. And I had a friend in college, Jeremy, that's all he would use. And I've never really, you know, gotten to use Slackware, like, you know, hardcore, like, you know, that's what my main system was. But you'd have to forgive me. There's thousands of distributions out there, and I just don't have time.
There's a ton.
Yeah. I just don't have time, but I do try and play around with, you know, the different, you know, bases. And, this is the first time that like there was actually something where, you know, I had a good reason to try something that was based on Slackware, because there were other distributions, but they were not good for blind users. So it was a good excuse to play around with it and check it out. You know, a newer version anyway than what I may have played with 20 years ago.
Yeah, so Slackware was how I got introduced into open source and Linux. And I still use it today, as I mentioned before. So anybody that's listening that uses Slackware, next time you're looking for a computer, order one from ThinkPenguin and specifically request that they install Slackware on it, so they have to actually deal with it more.
Yeah, I would love to get, you know, more people asking for other distributions. But to be honest, like, most people will leave the default distribution, you know, whatever that may be. And it's very interesting, because like you would think that more people would, like, you'd think that Linux users are, you know, they have a distribution that they want, right? And they know what it is. But the reality is, like, most of the people out there using Linux don't know a thing about it these days. Most users are technically very low. They're not very technical, is basically the best way to sum it up. And, you know, I'm trying not to insult people here, but like they're just not, you know, they use it, but they don't really know anything about, you know, like trying to like explain to them, okay, have you ever opened a terminal before? And you'd be surprised at how many times people say, no, I've never opened a terminal before. not that I try to avoid asking people to open up a terminal, but every once in a while, you know, it's just easier to open a terminal and, you know, do something than it is to, you know, open up the graphical interface to do the same thing. So
the only other thing I would wonder is if some people aren't changing it because they just automatically plan that they're going to install whatever. So they just leave it at that. That's, yeah. I wonder if that happens.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right.
It certainly does happen. But I don't think it's necessarily the case that it happens more often because of that. I think more often it's because, you know, 80% of the population, 80% of our customer base anyway, are non-technical, and it's like 20% that are technical. And there's probably like 2% that are technical that will just leave the default distribution. It's like a small percentage of people, surprisingly.
Yeah. And with the work that's gone into Ubuntu and Fedora, and of course, a lot of other distributions that are downstream from those, Linux has gotten very, very user-friendly. Like, I remember back in the day, it was definitely difficult. But
when we say back in the day, what are we talking about? Because I've been around a really long time in this world. So and most people, it's not 25 years or whatever.
So for me, back in the day is the 90s and maybe the early 2000s.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, that's so definitely pre-2000, I would say it was definitely more difficult to use. And post-2000, I think it became a lot easier, especially probably around 2005 and later time period.
Yeah, I put my mother on, I believe it was a Mint install, if I could be wrong, but I just sat her down with that one day and was like, you know, here's where the settings are, here's where you go, you know, to get online and stuff like that. And she went from, I think the laptop she had before was Windows 7, and she went transitioned over. She, you know, would ask me a few questions for the next couple of weeks. But then after that, she was fine. She got it. She could figure it out.
Yeah. I would say probably five or more years ago, I would say about 50% of the, like, non-technical people could use it, you know, reasonably, because they didn't have any kind of dependencies that would be or use cases that would be like, oh, you can't do that on Linux. Now it's like 80% probably. So. The main thing that was holding a lot of people back, in my experience, was actually QuickBooks. So now that QuickBooks is online, it's no longer an issue.
Yeah. So I had mentioned that I use Slackware, and I always have to admit this, and I feel kind of stupid about it now, but when I started using Slackware, I was given a box with Slackware installed. So for me, I didn't actually even understand that it was free and open source software. For me, it was just, oh, this is another operating system I can use and play around with it. And it wasn't till years later when someone was talking about some other package, I forget what it was, but some software that was open source. And they mentioned that it was open source. And I was like, oh, that's a really cool thing. And they kind of looked at me sideways and they're like, why are you acting like this is such a revelation to you? Like, you said you use Slackware. And I'm like, yeah, I use Slackware. And they're like, yeah, that's open source. I'm like, but that's Linux. That's just Slackware Linux. And they're like, yeah, that's open source software. And
that's funny.
Oh, okay. I thought it was odd that I could, you know, I could get source code in little bits that I could then compile stuff, but I didn't understand the kind of the deeper stuff with it being free and open source software.
Did you start off as a less technical individual on Linux? Is that how you got started, or were you technical but it just didn't occur to you?
So it's kind of a funny story. I was a DOS Windows user, and a family friend was a sysadmin. So I was constantly bugging this person with questions about how to do things because I couldn't figure it out, and I was younger. And they got sick and tired of basically being my tech support when I couldn't figure things out. So they spoke with someone that they worked with and said, can you install... That person was actually a FreeBSD admin. That person, my family friend, asked their friend, can you install FreeBSD on this little box so I can give it to this kid so he can stop bothering me? Well, that guy didn't want to become my tech support either. So he installed Slackware, which then was given to me by my family friend, who basically then said, look, I don't know how this works, but there's, you know, here's a list of simple commands using this man command where you can get information about how these other things work. And you're a smart kid. You can figure it out. So I just kind of got thrown into the deep end, and I would just, you know, play around with it, read commands, read the man pages. I still had another system that I could use so I could get online to forums and ask questions to get other information. But for me, it was just kind of a curiosity of, this is a different way that I can use an operating system, because up until that point, all I knew was DOS and Windows. So I was very much not a technical user, and just slowly over time learning things, learned how to use the system, but didn't understand the whole philosophy behind open source.
Yeah, my biggest thing that resulted in my use was probably, or at least moving to it full time as like my only operating system, was probably be the fact that like I went from DOS to GNU basically. So it was a situation where it's like, I can't stand Windows. I can't stand Microsoft Windows. Microsoft is constantly making these changes that just make things difficult to use. And DOS had its limitations too, because the sources weren't available. There was freeware all left and right, but there was no source code. And it wasn't that I was like looking to hack on the source code even necessarily, but there were just so many limitations surrounding that. And I had Windows, but it was like I would reboot to DOS like up until like Windows 98 second edition, and then after that Windows like XP around that time came out, and I took two looks at it and I'm like, I'm not going through clicking 10 times to configure my network, right? Like I don't know what they did. They like removed the network configuration. Like there was a single panel in Windows 9X, and then it went to like a wizard, and I'm just like, I've had enough. And I'm like, I'm getting rid of Windows. I'm hitting the delete button on Windows altogether, and DOS and all of it. And I'm just like, whatever it takes to get off of Windows, to get off of DOS isn't doing it anymore. You know what you've removed. I already wasn't happy when they removed the reboot to DOS option from the Windows. I think that was actually in Windows ME. That also didn't make me happy. And so I think I played around with hacking on that, but it was like, this isn't an answer because it's just going to go away, you know, in the next release. So it was time to say, and I had been using, I'd been using Linux for years prior, but at the time, 2000, there was still a lot of things that were like, little issues, and they could kind of be like big enough issues to be a real kind of, I don't know if I want to say deal breaker, but it was like, it was hard. I had like a DVD or CD writer, maybe I was probably CD writer at the time. And I couldn't use my CD writer on Linux because I don't remember why. And eventually it worked, but it was just like, it was still not where we weren't at a point where, things mostly worked or, anything of that nature. Even years later, I was still like running into issues. Even in 2005, I was running into issues, and people were running into issues. I was in that point. I was actually working for a company that developed a distribution, and they were doing it wrong. They were doing it all wrong, and I'm trying to explain to them what they're doing wrong, and it's like, no. You need to sell hardware. I'm like, I know you're a software distribution. I know you're in the software. I know you're in the software business. I get it. But if you want people, and the whole point of the company was to sell, their distribution to non-technical users. And it's like, if you're going to throw your computers on fries, and I'm trying to think Best Buy, and I'm trying to think what the other one is on the West Coast.
Circuit City was around then.
I think they had them in Fry's, Staples, Best Buy, one to one degree or another, either computers with it installed already or box copies. Micro Center, I think, was the other one. Micro Center and Fry's were the two ones that I think were selling computers. But they were doing it all wrong, because one of the issues was that they were basically, Linux was just being used as this cheap thing to lower the price of it. So there was no licensing from Microsoft. And so they were using that to like bring customers into the store, but then they would upsell them on Windows, like a higher end Windows system. And the system that you would get with Linux was garbage. The hardware was garbage. And it was like, if you want people to actually like use this distribution, you need to solve the hardware problem. And they just weren't willing to do that. And they'd solved, like they made it easy to use, like the user experience. But then they would do things like they would tell people, oh, go look at this hardware database and buy, this modem, this Win modem or whatever. And it's like, okay, I know the Win modem works right now, but what happens when you go to upgrade to the next release? And do you know what they would do? They would be like, oh, you have to, this is the crazy thing. So they would basically have people call up for support, and they would be like, okay, look at our hardware database to buy a modem, because their Win modem that they had doesn't work. So then they would get directed to buy another Win modem, which worked with that release. But then when the next release came out, it didn't work anymore. So they call them up again and be like, is that really going to work? How many, every 3 months you have to replace your modem or whatever? Like, that's not going to work. So you know, I was trying to explain to them, like, you need to solve the hardware problem. You need to actually do basically what Apple was. I don't know if Apple was doing this yet, but they had started at some point. They did these Apple stores inside of CompUSA stores, and basically they need to do something similar, and they didn't have to do it. I wasn't suggesting that they do it like that, because I didn't think the company had the resources to do that, but they could have taken the Dell model, combined it with the Apple model, and had a, you know, an internet store where people could buy hardware and, you know, and solve, and then solve that problem that way, because it's not, you can't just recommend like hardware to people, because the hardware and the databases, there's so many different issues with hardware databases. But one of the issues is, you know, that you don't, the customer doesn't get, if what's in the hardware database is up to date and accurate and stuff, if you go out and try and buy the hardware and you get it, it's still probably not the hardware that was originally, the chips that were used are probably not the same chips that were in the hardware when it was tested and said, this works. So you actually end up recommending something that doesn't work. And more often than not, and the 9 out of 10 items in the hardware database are out of date, and or out of date in that they're not even available on the market anymore. So it's like you, it just doesn't work. They you end up getting swamped after a short period of time, swamped with there being more hardware that isn't available on the market, and the little bit of hardware that is available on the market that you might be able to still get doesn't have the same chips. So it doesn't actually work. And, you know, and I was trying to explain this to them, but like I was only interning for the company, so it was like nobody was gonna listen to me. But they did try to hire me twice actually after that, and I actually ended up turning them down, because I'm like, yeah, you guys are gonna go out of business in 6 to 8 months. At least the last time they tried to hire me, and they did. So it was a good decision not to go and work for them. And even though I liked what they were doing or trying to do, I think they got a lot of flack and criticism that was partially deserved, but I think they fixed a lot of their issues. And the best thing I ever did was start a business out of college, immediately out of college. I took the harder path, but it was well worth it. So
yeah, hardware compatibility these days is so much better than what it used to be. And for some reason I'm hearing back my audio from you.
Really?
Yeah,
I don't know why that is. I'm talking into a microphone and I have headphones on.
Okay, let me try talking again. Yeah, I'm actually hearing my echo. Okay, I'll just deal with it.
In post.
I've dealt with like, okay, 2 second delay. It's just that it's doing that now, because it wasn't doing it earlier. So I don't know. Anyway.
I mean, do you want me to do something? You want me to disconnect, reconnect?
No, I've dealt with this before. I just do this, and then I can't hear my echo 2 seconds out of phase, and it doesn't bother me anymore.
Okay.
So that's fine. And of course, the benefit of being audio only is nobody is going to see me pulling my headphones in and out. So hardware compatibility these days is so much better than what it used to be. And I know back in the day, again, 90s, early 2000s, it was, I found it to be a nightmare, because at one point, I was upgrading. I don't remember if it was an audio card or a video card, but I had looked at what was, you know, the list that people had made about, oh yeah, we know this works. And the one that I had was like one revision off of what worked, but for whatever reason, something had changed in the hardware, so the driver didn't work for it anymore. So I had to find another card, and I went and searched, and I found one that looked like it was on the list, but I ran into that very same problem. It was a later revision of that card that I was actually able to buy, but I didn't know it was a later revision because, well, the name's the same, the box looks the same, like this is what I should get.
The model number is probably even identical,
right?
It
didn't work.
Yeah, this is a common problem, and it's not something that, honestly, like, we still have these problems, and I think a lot of people, they don't realize the problems when they encounter them often, or what they're relating to. And usually it's some sort of proprietary bit or something, but there are other issues too. And it's everything from, poor code. Sometimes it's like poor code quality. So it's something that'll never get, even though the sources are available, it'll never end up in the mainline kernel. And so there'll never be proper support. Other times it's that issue where you've got, a newer revision with a different chipset. Other times, there's some products that have 17 different revisions and the same model number. It's like, yeah, some of those revisions work, but some of them are like, they don't work at all. But there's also other issues, like sometimes manufacturers will produce the same model card, but they'll have two different versions of it, basically, but they don't tell you there's a different version. So like they'll actually be using two different ship sets, and it's just weird. I think probably the most prominent example of this that I can think of top of my head is actually Apple did something like that with their iPhone, I think. And they use like two different SoCs or whatever. And so like people were complaining about the performance on one over the other. And it's like, yeah, it's because they're two different products really under the hood. And if you were to, and I don't know, like, obviously that's not, you know, specifically to Linux. But this is really not something that's specific to Linux. A lot of the hardware problems actually people run into are not specific to Linux at all. They're actually just generic problems that Windows users run into too, but there's reasons that they may not run into them as much, or you know, or they don't understand the real problem, and they'll just write it off as, oh, that hardware is out of, you know, it's out of date or whatever. And they don't blame Microsoft. They should blame Microsoft because they're a big part of it, but they should also be blaming especially the manufacturers. But in the Windows world, everything's proprietary, which is mostly back to Microsoft. So, but in you know, GNU and Linux world, we don't have that situation where everything is proprietary. There's a lot of things that are proprietary, but there are still a lot of things that are not. So if you get the right hardware, basically you don't have those problems. But in the Windows world, you really don't have a choice, you know. And there's I'm trying to think some examples, but there's a sound card. There's a sound card's probably a good example. There was a my friend has a radio show, and he does basically, he had a sound card in a Windows system for that show. And he upgraded Windows, and the sound card didn't work anymore. Now, it still works in Linux, but that's because the sources are available and it's properly maintained in the mainline kernel and everything else. Or actually, I think it's a different project, but whatever. You get the idea. It's the community is able to properly maintain support for that hardware almost indefinitely. And that just doesn't happen in the Microsoft Windows world. So, but because people don't usually upgrade the operating system in Windows, they buy a new computer and then their printer doesn't work that they bought 6 months earlier. That's usually more what happens. But then it somehow gets blamed on, you know, old hardware. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that something that you bought 6 months ago would not work with your new computer. But that's just how things are in the Windows world. And I don't think, you know, people in Linux land, people blame it on Linux. And it's not really Linux, it's the manufacturer. It's if you buy crummy hardware, and I understand that people don't know what's, you know, garbage and what's not, and the people who recommend that hardware tend not to know what they're talking about either. So you get, and then the industry itself is like, even people who sell Linux, you know, Linux products, you know, they'll do the same thing. They'll sell you garbage. And it's just that drives me nuts. I much rather sell something that doesn't have the word Linux on the box, that works properly and has the good chipsets and the sources are available, than sell something that has Linux on the box, you know, from some company that, you know, I know in 6 months is probably not going to work with the next release or whatever. But yeah, I, and you know, it's crazy. Like I remember there being some, I remember there was a Samsung printer this one time, that had Linux on the box. And I was like, that's awesome. They, you know, they're advertising Linux on the box. This is, I don't know what time period this was, but it was like maybe 2000, somewhere between 2000 probably and like 2003, I'm thinking probably. They had Linux on the box, and it was a Samsung, I think it was a laser printer. And I don't know how I don't think I bought this printer, but I was doing some sort of support for this printer on Linux. And I plugged it in and I go to download the drivers, and I realize it only works with like Red Hat 4.0 from 5 years ago. And it doesn't, you know, it's a proprietary driver and it doesn't work with any recent version of Linux. And it's like, I don't know. It's like, how can you, and this is the crazy thing. It's like, companies put like Linux on the box and it's like it's absolutely not useful at all. And then it's like, I mean, what do you think is going to happen when somebody buys your product and you had Linux on the, because of it said Linux on the box, and then it doesn't work? They're going to return it more than likely. And if they return it, that has a cost to you. So you would think they wouldn't do that kind of thing. But they do. And what's funny is actually some of the best supported hardware is actually from companies who are not listing Linux on the box. Especially back in the day, they weren't listing Linux on the box, but they were they were releasing source code for their like printers and things of that nature. And so their printers worked great, like HP, for example. But they never, not all HP printers, at least select HP printers. But they would never put Linux on the box. And on the one hand, it's like, I wish they did. But on the other hand, it's like, I understand sort of why they don't, because of support issues, and they don't have like a tech support you can call up and provide end user support for. So I kind of got that. I kind of get it. But it was, yeah, it's just, anyway. Yeah. So it ends up being, you know, the best solution was basically like an Apple shop, like for Apple products. But in this case, it would be for Linux. And that's basically how the whole Linux thing, the whole ThinkPenguin got started, was just because I was sick and tired of there like not being a good source for hardware, you know, that worked properly, you know, under Linux and free software operating systems. So, and I know I say free software operating systems, I'm not really explicitly meaning only ones that only include free software. I'm also including in that at the moment, at least, all distributions, even the ones that include the proprietary components. Actually, the proprietary components kind of get in the way because people end up installing Linux and they think their hardware works, and then when they go to upgrade, the hardware stops working because, well, it worked before, but because of those proprietary components, now it doesn't work anymore. So that drives me nuts too. It's like, I wish people would stop installing. I mean, I want people to use Linux and GNU and free software, but if you install it on random hardware, people end up getting frustrated, and then they give up, and then they go back to Windows, and it's just like they will never use Linux again. And I think a lot of, you know, until you've tried to do that or tried to support people, you know, for a long time and a lot of people and so forth, you don't realize what kind of damage that's causing to their reputation. And people say Linux is hard. Well, Linux isn't hard. It's just, you are telling them, you're giving them bad advice, and then all these people end up with bad advice, and they do bad things that don't, they end up having such problems that they shouldn't have had if they just had gotten better advice. But you know, it is what it is. I mean, you can't, I can't roll out, you know, ThinkPenguin shops across the United States or world to fix this problem so people can walk into a physical brick and mortar store and get support. We just don't have those kind of resources. But to the extent that we can do that, is to the extent that people do know how to get hardware, you know, we basically have the Dell model as far as, you know, Linux is concerned. And Dell, basically, for people who don't know what the Dell model is it's basically Dell went to a catalog, phone, radio, television. You could not go into a store and buy a Dell computer. And so that's basically the model that we went with because of, you know, resource limitations. And, It worked great for Dell. When Dell was the number one spot for, you know, computer sales, that's the model they were using. So it's a model that works, and it works for non-technical people. It's just a matter of making sure that what you're giving them, what you're providing them, isn't garbage. Because if you give non-technical people garbage, they're going to be calling your support line all day, and you're going to go out of business because you can't afford to support people, you know, like that. It just doesn't work. So.
Yeah, it's interesting that the conversation went that way, because one of the reasons that I really understood and got the Libre and the open source concept was, like I mentioned, you know, cards not working. One of the cards I had, I forget what it was at a later point, but it didn't work. And in searching, I actually found someone who was like, oh, actually, that card will work, but you have to take the source code from the prior model card, change these values, you know,
the device ID,
something
probably.
Else.
Yeah.
And then recompile it and it'll work fine.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? It's a different card. And they're like, no, it's really not. There's just, you need to change these few identifiers
right.
The kernel can then actually see the card and know that it's there.
Yeah. So, I mean,
so I did that, got it up and running. And then I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, I like, with help from someone else, I was able to get something that didn't work to now working. And it wasn't difficult. I just needed a little bit of information to know. And now I have something that's working that wasn't working for me prior. Like, this is a win for me. And that for me was like one of the key moments where I was like, okay, I love this open source Libre thing, because this is amazing, because if I have the knowledge, I can solve my own problems. So I'm kind of curious, was there a specific moment for you where the light bulb sort of went off? Some people have those kind of certain moments that stand out. Others, it's just a longer period of exposure. And I'm kind of curious as to which of those you would fall into.
So there was actually another reason that I was very much concerned about the proprietary software. It had to do with security. It's something I don't really want to get into. But I have reasons to be concerned about the security of everybody's system, and it's you can't begin to talk about. We still can't talk about security today. We don't have a complete set of source code for everything, but you're not going to be able to start talking seriously about security until you get a complete set of source code for everything. So you got to start somewhere, and I've been concerned about this issue since, you know, the late 90s, and things are sort of better in some ways in that regard, and in some ways they're worse, but worse might be hard to get worse. I mean, it's not like there weren't wind modems and other proprietary components back in the 90s too, but I think there was less bloat back in the day. There's more bloat now. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of a toss up, right? Like you got back in the 90s, I don't know if I would say there was less. So there's something that's been changing over the years in the industry. Back in the day, you had a lot more hardware than you do now. A lot of stuff is done in software and firmwares. And so that opens up more security issues. And I'm not saying, I know somebody's going to come out there and say, but you could do the same thing in hardware. Well, yeah, you can, but it's a lot harder. It's a lot easier to put a backdoor in software, right? This opens up because we don't have free software at the firmware level in most cases. So there's all these places that you can hide backdoors, and it's not a theoretical problem. It's a real problem that you can point to tons of examples of, whether we're talking about routers or we're talking about, actual computers, or we're talking about phones. All of these, components, and it's not just those. Those are some of the ones that I think of, that I have examples of, but there's other places you could potentially, hide, basically malware, in a computer, a backdoor. And I've seen some of this, I've seen firsthand, some of it, I see secondhand, but, there's the Chinese government, for example. This isn't something that's been ever published, but this is something I know for firsthand anyway. But basically, the Chinese government. So there was a laptop that was basically a homegrown Chinese design, and it was done through government funding of a Chinese university. And they designed the laptop, and then they licensed it, that design, out to factories and things. And so other companies could build build what you would end up getting as a consumer product. And one of the ways they backdoored it was in like the keyboard. There was a chip for the keyboard and LCD controller firmware, I'm assuming. But the back door was in that component, but there was apparently like a driver component that it was dependent on. And apparently it, like, the back door stopped working if the driver component was made. It was just a very weird back door. But the point is that it's hidden inside those proprietary pieces. And it's not just that. There's other examples of back doors, like in BIOSes and things of that nature. There was a backdoor that was demonstrated with Intel, and it basically, I'm trying to think how that worked. So basically it would like send a password. There's like remote control software it's marketed as remote control software for enterprises, but basically it allows you to remotely control your fleet of computers. But what happens is, if you set a password and a client sends to the computer a good password, it lets you in. But if you send a bad password, bad password, it usually won't let you in. But if you send no password, it will also let you in. And the thing is, the client software wouldn't let you send a blank password, but if you modify that software, then it will let you send a blank password. So it's basically a backdoor hidden in plain sight that can be denied later as a bug, but is clearly a backdoor, because even a 101 CS student is going to know that you validate the input on both ends. And the fact that they didn't do this, and these are not, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of, crummy written software in that area. But this was something beyond your normal level of messed up. And but then you also see like routers. There's a, probably a bunch of different routers. I mean, the whole router world is a nightmare, but there's routers that have two or even three back doors that, you know, have been revealed. If you follow the news a little bit, the tech news, and it's like, how do you have two or three different back doors? How many governments, you know, have their back doors written right into the code like that? And again, it's the proprietary pieces. But then you also go on, like if you start talking about phones, now there might be a back door in the modem, you know, as well, firmware, but there's also a back door in proprietary components of Android that have been discovered over the years too. And they're on every single Android device. The only basically phones that didn't have that back door were possibly like Lineage OS, and I believe Replicant for sure. And it was only because, I think it was because of Replicant, if I recall correctly, that they discovered the back door, effectively that, or I don't know if backdoor was quite the right word in that particular case. I don't know if it was a backdoor, but it was basically collecting information on the user and sending it back to somebody. I don't remember who it was, but it was a while ago now. But yeah, I mean, it's always these proprietary components. And so if you want to start talking about security and you want to, you know, have a serious conversation, we need to get rid of those proprietary components, and then we can start having that conversation. And there are certain devices that we do not have any low-level proprietary, you know, pieces with, but it's rare. It's pretty rare. You know, there's the USB Wi-Fi. I worked on ATH 9K HTC, which is like basically the USB Athros Wi-Fi chipsets. So I worked with Adrian Chad and Luis Rodriguez years ago to get sources released for the firmware portion of that. And so all the USB Wi-Fi adapters that, you know, work well and properly, you know, are basically based around those chipsets. And that was huge. That was great. And the fact that, you know, that was able to happen, but that's really, really rare. And even like with routers, it's like same, we have the same problem with routers, and the FCC hasn't made it any easier, but there's LibreCMC, which is a free software project that my company has primarily funded and pretty much is the reason it exists, though it sort of predates ThinkPenguin, but there's something called LibreWRT prior to that, and the lead developer who was working on that basically left over disagreements, and then it was like, well, we want to put out a free router, and it's like, how do we do this? And so eventually I started talking to the guy, you know, who worked on LibreWRT, and he wanted to do LibreCMC, but he needed to feed himself, right? I mean, these developers, you know, they can't work for free forever. And so we started funding that. And so, you know, that pet project of his, LibreCMC, and then that eventually, you know, built that up, and then the LibreWRT folded into that. So, because LibreWRT at that point was basically dead. So yeah, that's one of the few free products that have free firmware on the market. It's the only totally free routers, are the ones basically that we sell in our catalog, where there's a complete set of source code for everything, including the bootloader. There's other companies that have routers that run LibreCMC, but they don't have a free bootloader. I'm trying to think. Or you can run the LibreCMC distribution on it, but they don't ship with it, if that makes any sense. So it's, yeah. there's probably like a dozen products, and like 9 or 10 out of the dozen products that run LibreCMC and have been sold commercially are our products, our ThinkPenguin's products. So it's kind of neat.
Yeah. Two anecdotes on that front. People always like to talk about how, you know, oh, well, these are just hypothetical scenarios where some piece of software, some chip somewhere will have a bad effect. Now, I cannot confirm, because I'm sure if this is true, this is probably classified. But I have heard for years that back prior to the Gulf War, that we had actually been selling computer equipment to the Iraqi government that they were using in their military. And when, I guess it would have been the CIA, was under the belief that hostilities were going to escalate, they actually worked with the suppliers to include other things into the hardware. And one of them, from the story that I've gotten, is that they actually hid some stuff in a printer that when was then hooked up to the other systems that obviously the printer would be hooked up to so it could print,
yeah,
created a vulnerability that then when we wanted to go in, the intelligence services had the ability to compromise the Iraqi radar system because that just happened to be where that printer ended up going. Because of, you know, where the purchase orders were, they knew that that was going to be used in a defense system, and they were able to implant something that then later they could take advantage of if they ever needed to for their benefit. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's, and there's, I don't know, this particular story is probably true and accurate because what you're saying, because there's even stories actually within like the past year, that basically, I don't know exactly how this story came to be, but it's like it happened basically. Somebody leaked something or other. And, there's two different Switzerland customers who basically were selling, backdoored fax machines and secure fax machines. I put secure in quotes here, secure fax machines to militaries and, you know, everybody all over the world. And they're supposed to be secure, but because there were proprietary software in them, they had backdoors, and those were CIA front operations. So they own the companies, and this is how they operate. And if you ever wonder why, you know, Russia and, you know, some of these other countries are coming out, or they've been, you know, funding certain chip manufacturing and designs and things of that nature, it's because of this very problem. It's if you source your products from companies in other countries and you don't have full control over those products and you can't vet those products reasonably, you're going to end up with backdoors in your supposedly secure infrastructure, and it's going to totally undermine your ability to defend yourself. And the printer world is terrible. I don't think there's a solution to solving that problem. Short of getting sources released for at least the firmware for printers, but there isn't anything, and that changes constantly. So, you know, there's different levels of support when it comes to printers and sources being released. So you can get printers that are better than other printers, but that doesn't mean that they're secure or safe to use. They're likely all, you know, backdoored in some way. It is what it is. The HP printers, for example, sorry, I shouldn't say all HP printers. It depends. So if you look at the sources for the driver, basically, it will, or the installer or something of that nature, it will go out when you plug the printer in, it will go out, it'll detect what printer you've got, and then it will say, okay, does it have a proprietary firmware? Does it need to load a proprietary firmware? And it will go out and it will download the firmware. Now, it turns out those printers are the worst printers to get, even though they work on Linux. Work, and I'll put work in quotes, but it's like 3 hours. I've done this a number of times now, but I've banged my head against the wall. Well, the first time this is the second time I'm thinking of, but I've had this happen before. This is a number of years ago since I've done this last, but I forgot about the fact that HP had models that were listed as being basically not dependent on a proprietary plugin, but they actually are dependent on a proprietary plugin. And so I like to, we always vet like the products that we get in and make sure like what we're selling is actually not garbage. And so we double checked. And when we were double checking, I realized, oh, it's going out and it's downloading a proprietary component to load. And I think I realized this before I even plugged the printer in. And, but I plugged the printer in and I'm like, oh, yep, it's doing exactly what I thought. So this isn't a good printer. And But what happened then was I was like, well, let me set up this printer just so I have a good idea of like, you know, what happens with this, because remember, I don't use proprietary software, right? So, but I'm always telling people about how these proprietary bits get in the way and cause problems. So I'm like, let me verify, you know, like, because I have a device here that's dependent on proprietary model, let me go ahead and test it and see what my user experience is like. Well, 2 hours later, I managed to get it to print one piece of paper out. All right. Now, I couldn't get it to print a second time, a second thing, but I got one thing to print. Now, an hour later, I had given up. 3 hours of my time basically wasted, but it was all for the sake of verifying I'm not crazy. And every time I'm telling people stop buying the proprietary garbage, you know, what I'm saying is actually accurate. And it is. And this is, like I said, when you have a free driver with printers, that doesn't mean you're safe. It just means that you're a little bit better off than if you have a printer that's dependent on more proprietary components. The ones that have a free driver that don't depend on the proprietary plugins with the HP printers, they definitely, they work a lot better, and they're the best printers on the market from a support perspective. And like you're not going to be banging your head against a wall. But if you get the wrong printer based off of what HP is telling you is, you know, supposedly a better printer, if you trust them, you there's a good chance you're going to end up with a printer that actually, no, it's not good. And the thing is, I believe actually those same printers don't work well in Windows either. So, I have been told by somebody, who I believe he set up a printer for somebody else that was running Windows. And I found out that, oh yeah, they don't work well in Windows either. So, and I don't know if that was, it might be even more true when it comes to other printers that are more free software friendly on GNU Linux, because they're all proprietary on Windows, remember. So there's a good chance that, you know, well, I can already tell you, I know that those printers are not going to work in 6 years from now, or 4 years, or 2 years from now even, because, you know, when you upgrade to a new version of Windows and you need a driver and it's not available because, you know, the manufacturer doesn't support it and don't release updated drivers, you're just screwed, right? So, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, on the firmware front, that's something that a lot of people, they're like, oh, well, this has open source software drivers. This is good. Well, I have been dealing with three issues of this at work this past couple of weeks, because of Intel and network cards. So they released in February that there were a whole bunch of vulnerabilities, and really ballsy of them too, in the announcement they even put that we don't anticipate that this will gather much media attention. But the three network cards was the 700 series, the E810, and the I210. Now the 700 and the E810, they're like 40 to 100 gigabit. So not something that a lot of people are going to run on, but obviously enterprise does.
Yeah.
But the I210 is just a gigabit Ethernet port. And I was looking through to try, okay, well, where's the upgraded software? Well, you can't get it. Now for the 700 and the 810, they released binaries that anybody can run. You can just go to the Intel site, download it, run the binary on your system, and it'll upgrade the firmware. Good to go. So, okay, at least you've announced the problem, you've put out the fix so that we can get it, and you've made it available for us to install the updated firmware. It's still closed source. I don't like that, but at least we have the firmware patch to be able to update. However, the 210, not so much. So they put out some updated software, but I couldn't tell that the driver was actually doing any of the stuff that it would need to do to block the CVE that they released. So I got in touch with somebody at Intel and I was like, look, you've got to help me make sense of this. Like, what is this? And they looked into it and they're like, actually, this doesn't really make much sense to me. I'm going to loop another one of my coworkers on. And that Intel coworker was like, oh, well, what you need to do is you need to sign up at our resource and design center. And then you can download the firmware. And then you can also download the tools to be able to flash the firmware, and then you'll be fine. Oh, except that you actually have to sign an NDA with Intel to be able to get access to the firmware binary to flash onto your system. So it's like, you guys have publicly announced a CVE. You release some source code. You're like, oh yeah, this goes with the driver for that thing that we announced the CVE to. But actually what I need is the firmware, which you've got under NDA, which you're not giving me. So how is that helpful?
Yeah,
The answer is I have to go to the actual board manufacturer and bug them to then put out an update because they have access to. No, this is not the way things should run.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, it's insane. And it's like, and this is the thing, it's like most people don't understand like the problems. So it's trying to explain it to people, you know, I can't tell you how many. I mean, I guess it's not been that often, but like every once in a while, I'll have somebody like I'm talking to and they just won't believe a word I'm saying. And it's just like, Yeah, I don't know. It's just like, you know, they're coming at it from a certain perspective, and it's like they're gonna be, they're intentionally blinding themselves, you know, to what the situation is, and for one reason or another. But it is what it is. So, I mean, you can't save everybody. You can't help everybody. Some people you just kind of let them, you got to let them crash and burn and learn for themselves to whatever extent that they're going to learn. And some people will never learn. And that's just, you know, that's what it is.
So this leads to an interesting question. And that is, do you think that the slow trend that we see of open source hardware starting to pick up is going to advance in pace? Do you think more people are going to get interested in it? Because like you have things like RISC-V and you have Open Power, and a friend of mine is the lead of the LibreSock project. So it seems that there are projects out there that have said, no, we need a fully open stack from silicon all the way up through the software to what the user sees. We need it to be all open. But it's slow going. Do you think that there's going to be a point where that becomes the standard, or at very least will become more common, so there's not the difficulty in obtaining that hardware that we have today?
I mean, this is a good question. I mean, theoretically, we should probably see something along those lines. Like let's be honest. It's, you know, Linux, you know, GNU and all that has undermined a lot of what we have had in the past. You know, Windows doesn't dominate today. It's a minority operating system. You know, Mac OS X doesn't dominate either, for that matter. You know, most devices are running some form of free software. And I think at the end of the day, probably, you know, to the extent that we're able to get more code, you know, released for more devices, those devices that have the code are going to dominate on the marketplace. But it's hard to, you know, it's really hard to tell for sure, because at the end of the day, you know, when we get source code released, oftentimes for, you know, some of these low level components, they have a huge benefit for the companies that are selling hardware based on those chips and things of that nature. But that doesn't necessarily translate into somebody, you know, some executive in power, you know, understanding that the reason that their products are popular is because they release the source code, or those chips are popular. And they just don't make this connection. And so, you know, it can take years to get management on board and understanding that. And then, you know, like what we saw with Qualcomm, you know, the management changes and you basically have to start all over again. And then of course the people who were the primary reason that the management understood previously leave, and they go to form their own company or do something else, and you're starting all over. And when you only have one company that was doing that in the first place, you end up taking two steps back. It's like, you know, I would like to think it's you know, two step forward, one step back, but I don't know. I mean, it may in some respects be at certain levels we are doing two steps forward and one step back, and then in other areas we're doing one step forward, two step back. And I don't know. I mean, it's hard to tell. There is still so many issues that we've not conquered ever. You know, when it comes to chips and things of that nature, you know, printers, a good example. And like hard disk firmwares, and like, you know, it's not to say that there's not people working on projects to do stuff, but it's not sufficiently funded. There's certain things we can do to like wean ourselves off some of these dependencies, but it's still a huge, you know, it's a huge effort, because most people don't understand the problems, don't care about the problems. They're in it for the money, or they're in it for something that isn't, you know, what's going to be best for my customer. It's, you know, what's going to be best for me. And that's cheap. That chip is cheaper. So we're going to ship with, you know, Raspberry Pi. We're going to ship with the broadband, you know, Broadcom chip instead of, you know, I don't know, Rock chip, you know. And I don't even know if those, you know, one chip is cheaper than the other in that case, but at the end of the day, that's what's going through these people's heads. And it's like, okay, yeah, it's going to be cheaper and you're going to make more money or whatever. And you're going to achieve your objective, whatever that objective, you know, is, but it's still not necessarily going to be the best thing. And so, you know, it's, I don't know. It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell there. I mean, there have been some things that are, you know, making progress. There's something called Yoma 68, for example, and there are Yoma 68 cards. It's taken way too long to get it, you know, done in shipping, but we participated in helping to crowdfund and market and promote it. And we also funded the original design and engineering of a modular computing is basically what it is. But the objective of that is to reduce the cost of designing and manufacturing devices that are not dependent on any proprietary components. And so theoretically, if you can scale up the demand for a core computer, basically, and then design housings around it, it's not as expensive to come out with all sorts of projects because you don't necessarily have to, you could do the design once and you can upgrade the product just by swapping out a card, and then you can scale up the card, you know, because it's not for one device, but it's for many devices. But, you know, it's expensive. I mean, it's expensive. And that's not a chip problem. That is we have the chips. We just don't have them all in a single product. So that will make it easier to bring devices to market that are totally free, you know, from tablets to routers to, desktops and laptops and all sorts of different devices, potentially. I still think it's got the most potential. You know, we haven't seen it yet. We do have the desktop. I think it's 1,000 desktop words, or no, 500 desktop words and or housings, and 1,000 Yoma 68 cards have been manufactured. So I physically have a certain percentage of those, and they exist. So it's hopefully, you know, it's still going to take time to get that stuff shipped out to people who support that crowdfunding campaign. But I've taken on the responsibility, I guess, of getting that stuff out to those who supported the crowdfunding campaign. I wasn't the one who ran the crowdfunding campaign. I just helped with the crowdfunding campaign and supported the project, both in funding it and getting it off the ground, and then, you know, to make people aware of it. But to a good extent, you could say I was heavily involved, but I'm not the person leading that project. Luke is. And it's a great project. I'm hoping to see, you know, that progress further. And then hopefully, you know, we can work on, you know, the risk stuff, coming out and designing a CPU, and an SoC that, you know, that's a huge, you know, people don't understand, like, you might have a $500,000 project that you can get off the ground and take 10 years, but designing an SoC and a chip and getting that manufactured and everything like that, you're talking tens of millions of dollars. So it's a way bigger project. And whether or not we don't even know if we're going to fully succeed with, you know, Yoma 68, let alone, you know, something as crazy big as that. But there's also, you know, there's other things that are, you know, potentially, you know, going to, you know, make that move along. And some of that's things like grants and government funds that, you know, come in. And I'm not a big fan of that, the government, you know, money, you know, handouts, but I'm certainly not going to refuse, you know, taking money, as long as it's not going to undermine or compromise, you know, what it is I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I am still shocked that the industry did not respond stronger to the Spectre and Meltdown stuff with Intel. Like, when that first broke, I remember thinking, oh, this might be one of those, you know, pivot moments where the industry goes, okay, we need to rethink how we're doing this and maybe have a shift in perspective. And obviously open source hardware is like, hey, I'm the answer, guys, like right over here, everybody noticing me. But it seemed that for most industry, it was just, we'll just deal with this Spectre Meltdown stuff. And yeah, systems might get a little slower, but that's fine. We don't need to change anything. We don't need to update our concepts of how we're actually building systems. No. We're just don't focus on anything else. Which is unfortunate, because I really do look forward to the day where there is an open stack all the way up and all the way down. Now, we talked about a few projects, but looking at free and open source software as well as other open source hardware projects, are there any other projects that you see or any other work that's being done that you get really encouraged and excited to see what comes out of that?
It's hard to get excited about it, to be honest, a lot of stuff, because it's so much of what you work on is so far out, as far as like, it's going to take a long, long time. And then when it finally comes out, it's like, whatever excitement you had, you're the one who's been working on it. And you know, for so long, it's not exciting. It's like, you knew it was coming. You just knew it was going to take forever. And so it's not, and you know, it's unfortunate because one of the problems, I knew this like when we did the crowdfunding campaign, this is one of the problems with crowdfunding campaigns is you can raise the funds that are needed to, you know, manufacture something. But if you want to make sure that you're going to be able to manufacture it and have it, you know, end up at the end of the day, getting out to people, you know, there can be delays and, you know, you might have a certain anticipation of how long it's going to take. But it might take a lot longer than that. And people, you know, they are used to, we have this instant gratification, you know, society, I guess. I'm not really a big fan of saying it like that, but that's how other people would probably say it. And people are like, oh, I bought this. No. That's not what crowdfunding is. That's not the point of crowdfunding. Crowdfunding is supposed to be to help projects do things that are otherwise not going to be possible. And people yet have this mindset of, oh, I bought this. No, you didn't buy that. You made a donation. And then of course, you know, it ends up taking longer to come out with something because you're not Intel, you're not AMD, you're not, you know, Microsoft, you're not. And then of course you end up with what looks really cool today and a couple of years from now might not look so cool. But of course the people who, you know, are upset, they went in it for what I would say are the wrong reasons. They didn't go in it for all the stuff that you are trying to sell, like the freedom or, you know, any of the other stuff. They're going into it because it's, oh, that's really cool. You know, a module computer is really cool conceptually, for reasons that have nothing to do with free software. And so a lot of people will be not happy when it finally gets released, and they're not looking at it from the larger picture. They're just looking at it from a toy, like it's a toy and it's cool and I want this. And now it's not cool anymore because there's other stuff on the market that's so much better and faster. But of course they're not looking at the whole reason that the project existed in the first place. They're looking at it because, you know, they don't have the interests that you have and the reason that you were doing the project in the first place. So, I think, you know, when it comes to like Yoma 68, just as an example, you've got to start somewhere, you know, and you learn and you get better at stuff as time progresses. So I think, you know, it shouldn't take anywhere near as long to come out with a second generation like card. Just as an example, the first generation card is only 2 gigs of RAM and a dual core CPU with a 15, 20 year old probably SoC at this point. But you know, the next generation, you know, will be twice as fast, twice as good. And it maybe will only take a couple of years to come out with, as opposed to, you know, the 15 years that it took to come out with the first generation. And so over time, you know, you progress, but you've got to build up those capabilities. And right now we don't really have a whole lot of people on the engineering side of, you know, the free software world, you know, working on those types of things. So we have a lot of people on the software development side, but not a lot of people on the hardware side, you know, actually designing, you know, hardware and chips and things of that nature. So we need more of that. And, you know, it's going to take a lot longer to build that experience up and that skill set, because we just don't have those people. You know, it's one thing to, and I know there's so many people out there who are, you know, they're like, they've got some idea of like fabricating and designing and, you know, hardware and stuff. And it's like, but they don't really have, they're clearly not experts. And they'll say things that are like, I could have done this in 6 months. And it's like, no, you couldn't have, because the sourcing of the components, we had to switch from one manufacturer to another manufacturer and then redesign this and that, because, you know, the components don't, like, they exist when you designed it, but they don't exist, you know, 2 years later. And, you know, you end up with this whole thing where, no, you couldn't have done that. And you don't know enough, you know, you clearly don't know enough. And the other thing is, it's like, well, first of all, the, like, a Raspberry Pi type of device, a mini board computer, yes, maybe you could have done it in 6 months, but this isn't a Raspberry Pi type device. It's not a mini board computer. This is a card that has very special, the package is smaller. So it's harder to manufacture, basically. And so it's not something, it's something that it is what it is. And if you want to go eventually get to what you're trying to achieve, sometimes things take, you know, they take time, and people just don't understand. They don't understand. It's like, and you can't explain it to them. You can't get them to care. You know, either you care or you don't. And if you care, great, help support the project. And if you don't care, well, maybe rather than buying into this, go do something else. Don't support it, because if you buy into it and then you act like, you know, you're owed something, which I'm not saying you're not, like, you don't deserve something, but I am saying that if you're gonna then want a refund in a year from now because it doesn't come out on time, you don't donate something to a project and then ask for a refund later. It's just like, you just don't do it. And, I think there's a lot of people who don't really understand crowdfunding. And it also doesn't help that you've got companies that are, I'm not a fan. I know there's certain other companies that are doing this, and you can probably think of some of these companies, but I'm gonna refrain from naming companies just because I don't think it looks good. But, you know, there's other companies out there that are basically using crowdfunding to, you know, develop their capital in order to do projects, and they're not doing anything that's all that unique or anything. They're just using it as a cheaper way to get a loan, basically. And it's like, I look down on that, because it's okay if that's what you're, if you're saying, oh, you know, if that's how you're doing it, like if that's how you're raising funds for your private company, but You've got to say that you've got to do it in a different way. And actually, I don't even think that's legal, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's actually, like, that's illegal. But anyway, but people are doing it anyway. And yeah,
the other problem you have is companies that will come up with an idea, crowdfund it because they know that will get them enough attention, and then hope they get bought by a bigger company. And that's really the right strategy from the get-go, right, is I just want my idea and company to be bought by a bigger company so I can retire and go away, right, and not give a,
well,
any care about what happens.
And this is the thing, like, you're literally profiting off of, you know, basically other people's donations. Like, that's effectively what you're doing. And that just doesn't seem right to me. I have no problem with people, you know, I'm not, like, anti-capitalism or anything like that. Like, go and support your business, do your business stuff. But, you know, to then ask people to donate money to you, and it's like, and I don't have a problem with, like, a company being like, you know, if you're putting out, like, a free product or whatever, and you're saying, give me a tip, you know, I'm very much a fan of tipping. Like, you know, I understand that, you know, not all products you're going to pay for, you know, like, just you're going to pay a set amount for it, right? Like, I totally get that. If you're a waitress, yeah, that's fine. I have no problem tipping. If you're running a radio show, I would love for people to, you know, who do podcasts and radio shows and produce content, creative content, to ask people for tips rather than, you know, charging for, you know, I don't even, what would you call it? I don't even know.
I don't know.
You know, like movies, for example, right? I would rather tip, go and, you know, tip somebody who creates a movie than to pay them some fixed amount for, I don't even know how they phrase it nowadays, but I would say buy a DVD, but obviously, you know, nobody's buying DVDs anymore. So, yeah.
Yeah. So when we were talking about board development, and you made the comment about, you know, somebody will look at it and they'll think, oh, I could do this in 6 months. So you clearly laid out how a lot of people that have that mentality don't really have the perspective of everything that's involved and how complicated things are. But what other pieces of advice would you give if somebody wants to get into open source software development or open source hardware development? What is some advice that you would give them before they start working on whatever project? Are there any other key points that you would be like, this is maybe something you should keep in mind.
I have no idea. Okay. I don't know. That's such an open-ended question. Maybe if it was more specific, more tailored, what are you trying to do? What's your objective? Maybe I have some ideas, but it's, I want to say business models or strategies for creating a self-funding project. It doesn't, like, I'm not saying you have to start a business in order to achieve your objective. There's other ways to achieve your objective. I can give some examples, I guess. Like, for example, Triskel and Linux Mint, both of them do something similar, but they have a working strategy for fundraising, and they have something Triskel Project calls it associate memberships. And basically it's just people donating a small amount of money every month to your project. And so that's one example of how to fundraise. Now, it's not the only way. There's other ways. Like, you can sell t-shirts, or you can sell, you know, there's all sorts of things you can do. You can partner with other companies. You can have advertising. Sometimes it's a little bit of A and a little bit of B. Linux Mint does a little bit of A and a little bit of B. They have something equivalent to the associate membership program, and they bring in funds from their user base because they support the user base. Not everybody, but percentage of the user base supports what they're doing. And then they also sell advertising. And so my company, for example, one of the ways we support some of these projects is actually through literally just buying advertising. You know, we're terrible at marketing, but we're great at helping fund other projects and keep other projects going by buying up advertising on sites or projects that are, you know, that we have, that we support. And, I don't know that it's, you know, one of the things with advertising is it's often not that effective. So a lot of the money that you throw out there for marketing and advertising is mostly just, you know, it's a waste of money. It's a waste of effort. It's a waste of time and energy. If you looked at, if I recall correctly, I think there was a study that was done or something, or a story that came out about how companies basically, they stopped during COVID their advertising and nothing changed. Like, nothing changed. So most of the money that's being thrown at advertising is basically a donation to marketing companies. If you're gonna do the marketing, you might as well do it to causes and projects and things that you want to see succeed. And so that's kind of been most of what we've done. We've done a little bit of, like, okay, it's not entirely, you know, we're not, our whole marketing budget isn't all going to, you know, the Triskel Project, a tour, or wherever, you know, all these other tales and some other ones, but it is, you know, it is the majority of our marketing dollars. There are some more marketing kind of stuff that we do with, like, going to conference. We haven't done that in a year or whatever, but we usually go to about a dozen conferences a year. And I would say that we do want to support, you know, conferences, but a lot of the conferences are, like, they don't need our money. We're more interested in talking to customers and people in the community and so forth. And that's why we go to them, but it is a marketing outreach effort more so probably than, you know, really funding something that it's worthwhile, but it's not as worthwhile as, you know, physically handing money over to a developer. One of the things I love about funding projects is that the money is actually being used, as opposed to, like, funding a corporate company, right? The money is being used for whatever it is that you're giving them the money for, right? Generally speaking, if you give a developer, you know, money, you know, they're actually going to be, you know, feeding themselves with it. They're going to be paying their mortgage or their rent or whatever it is. And so it's going to go directly into the pockets. Again, if the, you know, it's a small enough project and it's not, like, you know, run by some organization or whatever, but most of that money is going to go where, you know, to a good cause. So I like doing it that way as far, like, marketing and stuff.
Yeah. I remember seeing an article. It was what you were touching on, where companies stopped their advertising budget. And I think the figure that I saw was, like, $100 million in advertising money basically was stopped across a whole bunch of companies. Yeah. And yeah, the result was, like, it's not really a difference. Like, yeah, we're not really seeing any change in our bottom line from it. Well, let me take that question and let me skew it a little more specific and a little more personal. What advice would you have given yourself? Like, if you found a time machine and you could go back and talk to yourself 15, 20 years ago, are there any piece of advice that you would give yourself then?
Yeah, hand out a lot more business cards and don't even bother with any marketing, spending money on marketing, period. Just get rid of the marketing budget and do more physical hand, you know, and hey, just literally hand out business cards. I mean, it depends on what your business is, but generally speaking, I've run a number of different businesses over the years, and like one business, you know, it was focused on the local community. And I can tell you, I threw money at, you know, local marketing and advertising. And I have to say, it's, you know, if it brought in as much business as I spent in marketing dollars, you know, that's probably about what you're going to get. On the other hand, if you go around and hand out business cards, you know, all over the place, you know, you talk to people and so on, you're going to get a lot more business. And it's, you know, it's cost you maybe in terms of time and energy and effort, but it pays back so much more than whatever the time and effort that you put into that relative to just paying for advertising or whatever. Yeah.
So I had a conversation with a friend of mine a couple weeks ago, and we were just generally conversing back and forth about different things. And he came up with a comment that I don't want to say I didn't think of before, but I don't know if I put it quite into the words that he did. And I'm not going to be able to, off the top of my head, recall back and exactly the way he said it. But the gist of what he was saying is that the free and open source software, hardware model is, as much as we love it for software and hardware, that in many ways it's kind of a philosophy for life, in that it's about respecting others, about helping others, being open with others. And I'm kind of wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it, there might be more to that than the way you're wording it. And I'm not sure. There probably is. And I probably would have more to respond if it was worded a little differently, or I can tell it's being relayed, so the message isn't quite clear. And so the fact that I'm not quite sure exactly what the message is, it's kind of hard to respond to that, but I think probably so. That's the best I can say.
Yeah, unfortunately, I did not repeat it in such an eloquent manner as it was to me. Maybe one of these days I'll get him to say it back to me, and then I can reach out to you again and be like, okay, here was the way that was said to me that made a lot of sense, and now I want your input on it.
Yeah, like I have life philosophies, you know, and I think they're probably somewhat along the lines of what he was saying. You know, it's like, you know, don't harm others, right? Basically, I mean, it's a pretty fundamental tenet. You know, if you're not being harmed by somebody else, you know, don't, you know, there's no need to use violence. And that's probably, I don't know if that was quite what he was saying, but it's some sort of philosophy along those lines. And that's kind of how I feel. It's like, you know, whether it comes to software or hardware or, you know, life in general, you know, I want everybody to be free and do what makes them happy. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, it's not going to end up harming somebody else. And, you know, honestly, even if it does, sometimes it's like, there's a certain amount of, we get good things, but there's also usually some amount of harm that happens as a result too. And you may not know it, you may not see it, you may not intend it, but it happens. And so I'm not necessarily saying, you know, don't harm anybody. I actually think that's probably, I would say try to reduce your harm is the best way. Minimize it to the best of your ability. But I, you know, it's, you know, you're gonna, you know, in order to get the rewards, you know, you might have a massive reward, and if it's a little bit of harm, you're probably gonna end up, you know, being better off with a little bit of harm and massive reward. You know, if you have a little bit of harm or a lot of harm and not much reward, then don't do that, right? Like, you know, so.
Yeah, a little bit of difficulty and struggle is sometimes a good thing. I mean, I know working out sometimes really sucks
because yeah, right, exactly.
Like muscles being sore. But the result is so much better than the cost and the discomfort and everything.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah, it's not a black and white. You know, often stuff isn't black and white, and you know, you gotta take a little bit of the bad in order to get, you know, the good, and sometimes you know, end up suffering, but when it comes to, just generally helping people in general, you know, other people or whatever, you know, it's worth it. At least I think it's worth it. You know, I'm willing to suffer a little bit, you know, for the benefit of other people if that benefit is going to be, you know, substantial or good enough, right? You know, it doesn't have to be substantial, but you know, it's like to some degree, right? You gotta get more right than what you're suffering from. This is a terrible way to word all this, but
well, it works. And yeah, and honestly, I think this is the best point to end on is, you know, at the end of the day, what we want to do is, you know, we want to create a better world.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, I know I believe that. I know you believe that. So I think that's a good spot to end on. Chris, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Same to you.
All right. And I'm going to stop my recording and then save that.